Okay, we were talking, we're starting tape two here. I'm speaking with Lothar Eisenlohr. We were talking about, you know, going back, the terror of that you experienced going back to Germany. Talk about what you were saying off tape about the survival aspect of being plunged into a situation that you have no idea even existed.
Yes. Well, to me, the first inkling that things were not going to be as nice as they had been was my experience in crossing the Atlantic, the cold, the fear of being torpedoed, mother in the hospital with apparently on the verge of dying, and then arriving in the harbor of Marseille, and everything is blown up, buildings piled up in rubble. And then being taken by train into Switzerland, where it is mountainous and icy cold that winter with no clothes. So that was a foreboding of things to come. We were then transported across the Swiss-German border and told to get on with it and go where we were going. We had no German money. We had no, I don't know how it was arranged. But I recall walking along railroad tracks, in cold of winter with, no clothing or whatever assets that were brought along in trunks that we were allowed to take with us, were confiscated and stored in a warehouse. And we were told at some time in the future, we would have them back. So we wore what we had on our backs in clothing, carrying a little baby that was at that time probably 6 weeks old. And we took turns carrying this baby and trying to keep the baby warm in some way. No food, scrounging food wherever we could, eating raw potatoes out of the field and things like that. It was just a sudden transformation into a survival mode that, as a child, having lived in the in America, the country of plenty, being transformed suddenly into that situation was terrible for the children, I'm sure, and was very put my parents in total confusion because they didn't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So all you could do is go 1 foot at a time, go toward my mother's hometown, which was the closest one to where we needed to go. Mm-hmm. So shelter from shelter, and then shelter from the cold, food, shelter from attacks by American bombing. All of these things were constant needs. And so by luck, by good fortune, we survived and got to my mother's hometown. We were not received well by the Germans. They called us names.
What did they call you?
Well, they called us whatever they called American troops or whatever, because of the and as though we were the
enemy
personification of what they were experiencing in the bombing raids and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Although we had obviously not much to do with that, we had no money, so we became a burden, an instant burden on my grandparents, who were elderly at that time. There was no food being distributed. Not very much food being distributed in Germany at that time because the roads were destroyed, the bridges were destroyed. The farmers would not bring their food into the cities or the towns because money was worthless. So unless you had something to trade for what the farmers wanted, you didn't get any food, or unless you were related to a farmer. Mm-hmm. So... you know, that's the situation we were in.
Mm. How long did it take you, roughly, to get to your mother's parents?
My remembrance is something like probably 3 to 4 weeks.
Oh, my goodness. And where did you sleep while you were?
Wherever we could find a place to lay down. We were in, at one point, we were in Frankfurt. And Frankfurt was enduring 24-hour bombing at that time. And we were in a bomb shelter somewhere down way deep in the ground. And nobody left that bomb shelter because if you left, you lost your place. I mean, it was jammed as tightly as it could be. And to experience that, it was nobody. The toilet facilities were completely out of order, so the stench in that hole in the ground was beyond bearing. And you didn't leave because if you left, you wouldn't get your space back in the shelter. And so it was as close to hell as you could imagine, mm-hmm. and still be alive. So at some point, the bombings stopped for some period of time, and there was this one train that was going westward, onto which we could get. And as we drew near to my mother's hometown, which was about 20 miles west of Frankfurt, we came out of a tunnel, and my father started hurling us under the benches, and my mother was yelling at him, "What are you doing? Have you gone crazy?" And he, of course, perceived that we were being strafed by American fighter planes, and he wanted to get us under the wood benches for protection from the bullets, which, of course, was...
Not that much protection.
Not much that much protection. They got the train stopped, and we all were able to get off the train and flee into the woods until the action stopped. But again, it was another one of those experiences that were life or death, and luckily we survived. Mm. And we got to my mother's hometown from there. Mm. The war was mercifully over for that part of the Germany a short while later, maybe 4 to 6 weeks. In the meantime, my father was beaten up by the SS and arrested. He was charged with being a spy for the advancing American army, and he was taken away, and we didn't hear from him or know where he was or anything until after the war was over. So my poor father was jailed by his country of origin and his country of immigration for no reasons that he was aware of, and was pretty well beaten up by the SS. Burst into my grandfather's shop, pinned him up against a wall, and started beating him up, five of them all at one time. And I remember I jumped up on the workbench and was going to grab a hammer to help my father, and one of the men just grabbed me and threw me across the window. I remember flying across the room and smacking into a wall. And for a long time, I felt very guilty about not being able to help my father. But anyway, so again, we were without a father, without money, without food. Just what about luckily my grandfather had a small garden out at the outskirts of town, and I would go with him and dig up beets and carrots and things like that, and we were able to survive. Then the war was over. My mother luckily was able to contact an American commander of the whatever military detachment was in the town, and prevail upon him to look for my father and find him or something, because she said, "Look, he's the father of four American citizens here." And and they did find him somewhere. I don't know where it was. Uh-huh. In other words, the Germans hadn't killed him yet, but they were apparently preparing to do so. So, again, luck.
Mm-hmm. What about your grandparents? I mean, you had met them then for the first time.
Yes.
And they were elderly, and they're in a war zone. What were they like under those conditions? How do you remember them in relation to you? And
well, they gave us shelter and sustenance and love. They didn't make any distinction between where we were, or where we came from, or what we did. They willingly endured the burden of sheltering us and so forth. Some of the townsfolk said bad things to them and so forth. But again, we were human beings. It wasn't the question of whether we had assumed a new nationality, which was contrary to theirs. In other words, the politics of the situation did not enter the relationship with our grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the one pleasant factor there that was involved.
Yeah, and I guess your mother must have been happy to be with her parents, having
endured
so much.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was your what was the reunion like with your father after they released him?
Well, it was certainly joyous and joyful again. We still had a father, and he was alive, and he just had to heal from some of his injuries. And but there still remained the question of shelter and food, which ultimately we ended up living in some former abandoned army camp, some barracks, part of a barracks. And that's where we lived until my older sister and I were repatriated to the U.S. by the U.S. government.
Uh-huh. So from the time the war was over, mm-hmm. and the family was living in refugee, was it a refugee camp where these barracks were? Or?
I think it was some kind of green barracks that housed, I think, an army detachment that was assigned to that particular. It was a village. It was a town, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And it was abandoned. So obviously the soldiers went home or were
right.
captured or whatever, and so it was shelter. And so we ended up living there.
And were there a lot of families living there?
Well. Eventually, the units were filled up by refugees, and because there were plenty of those, and yes, they began. It was a mm-hmm. sort of a camp.
So, why was it that you and your sister came back here?
Well, initially? my mother had contacted the American occupation authorities, and did whatever was filling out papers and requests and so forth. And the authorities granted, they indicated that the children could come back to the U.S., but the parents could not.
Oh.
And so my parents, they said, well, the two younger ones were out of the question. The one was only a year old or so, and my younger sister was about six or somewhere in that range. But that my mother said she would allow us to go back. Did we want to go back? And we said, well, we think we should do that. Maybe we could then be helpful in getting them back. So that's what happened. We were then taken by the authorities and put in a refugee camp or a displaced persons mm-hmm. camp. We stayed there about 6 weeks or so, and got all kinds of health checks and that sort of thing. And then the same aunt with whom we had lived with after my father had been arrested agreed to become our sponsor, and we came back to the U.S. And they had in the meantime moved from Cleveland to Los Angeles, California after the war.
Your aunt that you went to?
Yes, uh-huh. And so we came there to live with them.
I see. So you must have had a lot of mixed emotions leaving your parents and coming here to an aunt that hadn't been all that good an arrangement before you left, right?
Well, she was always very nice to us. She was my father's oldest sister. It was not a question that we were kicked out of her house. It was they were poor, and they had this small home, and the only space in the home was in the basement. She had a son, and she was, in order to survive, they were taking children. Yes, what do you call them?
Orphans.
Orphans brought in from the social welfare system. Mm-hmm. So they had a 2-bedroom house, and there were people everywhere.
So
the only remaining space was the basement. So it wasn't like she didn't want us. It was in just in, and they were just it was the Depression. You know?
Right.
They didn't have any extra money to support four more people. She was always very kind to us, both my aunt and uncle.
So what year was it that you actually came back?
We came back to in 1947, about July 1947, I believe.
And did you, do you remember what ship you came back on?
Yes, SS Ernie Pyle. It was a troop ship.
Oh.
USS Ernie Pyle, yeah.
What, say it again, Ernie?
Ernie, E-R-N-I-E, Pyle, P-Y-L-E. He was a renowned World War II war reporter. I mean, a combat reporter.
Oh,
and
uh-huh.
He was killed in World War II.
I see. Yeah. And where did you come into? Where did you sail into?
Must have been here.
You think? Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, it was here. It was New York. Now, that's interesting. I haven't been able to look that up yet. We may have come back through Ellis Island. I don't know where.
You might have, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I have to do some research.
So you came here. Do you remember Ellis Island at all at that point?
I remember the Statue of Liberty.
Well, it's warm. It's close.
Well, yeah. I remember that because I remember being, as trite as it sounds, I remember that certainly was a welcoming sign and a very happy sign. But I remember we were on the ship and we stayed somewhere, and I don't know where the somewhere was when we came off the ship. And then at some point they put us on a train, and then we went by train all the way across the country. So I'll have to do some research.
Mm. So you and your sister, and you were about 12, I guess, somewhere around there.
At that time, I was 11 because I'm born in December,
right,
so I wasn't quite 12. Yeah, 11 and a half.
11. Mm. So you went to your aunt's, and your sister was still in school, too?
Yes. She was in high school, and I was in junior high school.
Uh-huh.
And we stayed with my aunt and uncle. My sister reached her, I think, 18th birthday, and she got married shortly thereafter. And I remained staying with my aunt and uncle till I finished high school.
And how was that for you, living with your aunt and uncle?
Well, it was a reasonably nice situation. They had bought a home in sunny Southern California, which had about 20 million fewer people at the time, so it was a very congenial place.
Mm-hmm.
Money was still tight, so I started a job when I was in junior high school and helped my aunt and uncle. I was very grateful that they had taken us in.
And what was your first job that you started when you were still in?
I was selling newspapers, standing on a double white line in a trafficked road, at an intersection.
And what would you do? Would you go someplace and get your papers? And how did it work?
The company would, I think it was with the Los Angeles Times, or I would drop off a stack of newspapers for me, and I would work until I had sold them all. And I'd stand in the middle on the double white line and sell to either side. And I think it was a nickel a paper, and I got to keep 2 cents or something like that.
Uh-huh.
10 cents a paper, and I got to keep 2 cents.
So did you do that in the morning before you went to school or in the evening?
It was the afternoon.
After
I got out of school.
After school.
Yeah. That's what it was, the Valley Times. It wasn't the
Valley Times.
It was the San Fernando Valley newspaper.
Yeah. I always find newspaper boys an interesting, because that's often the first job that a boy has.
Yeah.
And I guess it's a good experience, usually.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
in the sense of...
It was one I could do. I didn't own a bicycle, so I couldn't have a newspaper route. They said and I could stand on the corner. And I don't know how I was able to do that, because I was never admonished by the police or anything. After all, I was standing in the middle of a 2-3-lane road selling papers. I never got hit by a car or anything, and that's what I did.
Uh-huh.
And then I got a job subsequently in a grocery store as an all-around stock boy and things like that and so forth. So.
And then did you give the money to your aunt?
Yeah,
and
to
Paul?
My aunt and uncle, yeah.
Uh-huh, uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so...
Let's see. So now, were you in communication with your mother and father then?
Yes, so we would write from time to time, and my mother did most of the writing, and in fact, just about all of the writing, and she would inform us that she'd still be applying to repatriate, and it was constantly denied, and so they just kept trying.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't see them again for about, 47 to 56, about 9 years.
Mm.
And by that time, I had endured some other experiences and was in the Air Force in pilot training school.
Oh.
And I don't know the veracity of what occurred, but it was so simultaneous that I... reasonably certain it had something to do with it. I had to have a top secret clearance to become a pilot because we dealt with nuclear weapons and things. And so they denied my top secret clearance. And so I said, that's fine, just send me back home being where my aunt and uncle was, because my intention was to obtained the benefits of the GI Bill so I could go to college. Mm-hmm. And then they said, oh, just a minute. And they held me back. And whatever occurred, I got a letter from my mother saying that they had been granted immigration status. So it was coincident with my obtaining a top secret clearance that my parents were granted immigration status. Mm. So they came back through Ellis Island, I guess.
Really? Well, so in other words, you think that because they were being denied repatriation, you were being denied, but then somehow both things could happen if one happened, the other?
Yeah, I think there was a connection link there. And the conjunction of things that occurred, there are some other things that were happening that I can't substantiate. So I'll just let that go. But the timing was so complete. I mean, the prior communication I got was my mother was beginning to lose hope that she'd ever see us in the near future, and so on. And then I'm denied this top secret clearance. I'm held back out of the class and. Whatever government agencies do, I don't know. I didn't.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I get this joyous thing that they've been given immigration status.
And you were given top clearance. So,
yes. Uh-huh. So I had saved some money while I was in training, and they needed passage. So I sent that to them, and they were able to pay for their passage, and we were reunited in Los Angeles, California. Yeah.
So they probably came into New York.
They did come into
Ellis
New York.
Ellis Island. And then, and what year was this?
This would have been, would have been just around July 1956, because I was just graduating from that training class. And... they did give me a leave for 3 days, and I was allowed to go up to Cleveland and meet my parents. They came in through New York, and then went up to Cleveland.
Oh.
With another sister was living there, my father's, and my mother had a brother and a sister living there.
So that's where they settled when they came back?
No, they actually just stopped off there to say hello and sort of. Begin regenerating, and they came out to California and actually lived with my older sister and her husband for a while.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, how had the war changed them or affected them. Could you say anything about how they were having...
Well, I would say my mother was still as resilient as ever. She never lost hope about anything. She was always went on to the next thing, did the best she could, looked for ways to better her status, her situation, whatever. So she was still very, very resilient. My father was, I would say he was just about a broken man. He was pretty despondent, I would say, at that time. Not despondent about returning, but despondent about being able to resume a family situation. After all, they had nothing. He was 60. He had no career. His career, the people were not hiring 60-year-old men. He couldn't find a job. He found a job at one point where they hired him as a blueprint reader. I remember him telling me, he said, they give me the blueprints that these young college graduates are producing. They don't know what they're doing. Everything is incorrect, and they want me to, they have me correct it. I can draw these things. I can design these things, but they won't give me a job as a designer because of my age. And so he was very embittered by that, and he died shortly thereafter. He had a stroke, I think he went to the grocery market and had a stroke. Uh-huh. So I would say the experience for my mother, while it was not a happy experience, mm-hmm. she always endured and was resilient. Mm-hmm. My father became greatly embittered because the juxtapositions of things were so much. He didn't know why he got arrested here. He didn't know he got arrested there. There were so many ironies. He was hired by the U.S. Army to build their barracks for them in Germany. And he said, and so mm-hmm. if I'm this spy or I'm this unwanted one, why are they hiring me to build their dwellings for them and things like that? It's just nothing made sense to him. He couldn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. It just got arrested here. He got arrested there, and they took 10 years of his life from him at the height of his so-called career. You know? Mm. So it basically destroyed him.
But, yeah. How about the ramifications for you? I mean, part of it as a child was just an adventure, as you said earlier. But how about just overall?
Well, it had a bunch of ramifications for me. But I think I had more of my mother's spirit than I did of my father's spirit. Because a lot of things occurred to me as I was trying to become an adult and so forth. I was denied residency at university, residency status, because my parents were alive and in a foreign country. And I pointed out to I was attending UCLA at the time, I pointed out that I was gone to junior high school and high school in the United States, and my uncle and aunt were my legal guardians, appointed so by the federal court. And they said, we're allowed to make our own rules by the state of California, and we decide you're a non-resident. And so they wanted, I could barely afford the fees that were in existence then and the book costs and things like that. And now they wanted me to pay non-resident fees. So things like that, there were ramifications all along that occurred. Mm-hmm. But again, I had my mother's spirit, so I just went on to the next thing. You know? Mm-hmm. I said, well, how can I become a resident? Well, you can wait till you're 22. In those days, you had to be 21 to become adult. Right? And then a year later, and I was 17 at the time, what's the other option? Go into the military. Okay, I'll go into the military. So things like that. And as it turns out, I had fun flying. I mean, it was a joyful kind of thing for a male, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to pause here and turn the tape, and then we'll conclude on the other side. Okay, you were mentioning a sort of an anecdote that happened in Germany, about the American soldiers being in the town. Why don't you just say that for the tape? It's an interesting story.
Well, by chance, the area in which my family was living was occupied by American soldiers, And when the regiment of soldiers that were going to occupy our town moved into the town, I ran down to where they were setting up with some friends to watch them, and they yelled something at us that to get out of there and go away or something, and I yelled back in English, who are you talking about, or something of that nation, something of that type. And the entire group that were standing out there turned around and looked at me because I said this in perfect English, which they weren't expecting. I then was adopted by that regiment, and I was introduced to everybody around, and by pure chance, the chef of that particular regiment, the head cook, had gone to, I guess it would have been grammar school with my older sister in Strongsville, Ohio. And so by virtue of that friendship and prior contact, we were able to obtain foodstuffs from the U.S. Army, enough that for survival for our family, and also to use as trade with German farmers to get some foods like that, coffee and butter and things like that. We were able, and foodstuffs that were not available in the destroyed German economy. Yeah. So it was another quirk of fate that was constant between my family and our life as Americans. Even though some bad things occurred, there likewise some good things occurred.
Yeah. And I guess that was your first encounter with the American military, so
yes,
it was a good one.
Yes.
Well, actually, the first was sort of being bombed by them, right?
Yes. Well, that was, that had all kinds of ramifications, too, because the strafing was being done by American fighter planes, and I witnessed the Germans shoot down four of the eight fighter planes, and I remember standing there saying, the people, I'm an American, and the Americans are trying to kill me by strafing, obviously not me specifically, mm-hmm. but the Germans, whom I know nothing about, are defending me, and now these pilots are bailing out and being made prisoner, and they're Americans, something like I am, in a way, because I felt no kinship to Germans or Germany at that time, mm-hmm. because I had never been there, and my parents had not stressed that. So there were all these ironies that occurred mm-hmm. in my life. I also was further taken in as sort of a mascot by this regiment, and I was used. They made a little uniform for me, and I went traveled about. And it was a tank division, and they took me around, wow. taught me how to drive a tank at age 11. And I became the unofficial interpreter for different things they had to do. So it was, again, part of an adventure story, which was a little bit bizarre.
Yeah.
But ultimately worked to the benefit of our family in terms of survival.
Okay, so then you went into the military and you became a pilot?
Yeah, a fighter pilot.
How long did you stay in?
I was my total military service was about 6 years.
And then did you leave to go to the university? Is that what you did?
Yes, I was. Again, there's these quirks of existence. I went in through a program which I don't think any longer is used. During World War II, whenever there were shortages of particular categories of soldiers or things, they would have what they called cadet programs. So in this case, for pilot training, you normally would have had to graduate from an ROTC or a military academy. But they had a shortage of pilots, and they recruited as cadets. However, once you graduated, if you're not a college graduate, then if they have a time period where if they have an overage, then the first people that are removed are those who were cadet people. So I asked for release because they made it clear I wouldn't be promoted, even though my performance was outstanding. Uh-huh. And so I wanted to go back and get my college degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied for some scholarships and things, and then I was told I wasn't eligible for these scholarships. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, your class has graduated. And they had some arcane rule that when you went to university, this is California universities now, you had to matriculate within a certain given time in which your graduating, your high school graduating class matriculated. If you're, if you don't do that, then you lost all sorts of privileges, such as eligibility for scholarships and things like that.
Oh, wow.
So there were all these kinds of things that kept impacting my life along with my parents' life from this whole procedure.
Yeah. So I guess you had in mind you were going to get a college degree. Is that what? How did you go about it?
I just kept going to work and dropping in and out and going to work again until I could save enough money and go to class and get the units and got a degree.
So what did you? What was your field? What did you do after you?
Well, I didn't graduate in the field I wanted to graduate, and that was in engineering and science. In the meantime, during all this goings forth, I got married and a couple of kids came along. So now it was more and more difficult to save up enough money to spend, to focus on schoolwork with the intensity required for, say, a science curriculum. So I ultimately got my degree in international relations. I thought I would go into the diplomatic corps. That didn't occur either, but I did manage to finish college and do some graduate work. So I'm the only one of the family that did, so.
I see.
It was, I guess I have my mother's spirit.
Yeah. Well, it's you've used the word luck a lot during the interview. It seems like, I mean, even though incredible, negative things affected your family, you seem to have been lucky a lot.
Yeah, I use that word because there's no way one can make a rational explanation of why in all these proceedings I didn't sustain an injury leading to my death. I mean, there are many, many occasions where I was close to it, and yet I survived all these. So I used the word luck to say it was just by chance. There's no explanation for it.
Yeah.
On one occasion, I had an aircraft accident, and the plane tumbled round and round and round and upside down, and I had 1,200 gallons of fuel and, 600 rounds of ammunition and rockets and everything on the plane, and the plane didn't catch fire, and I was trapped inside the plane. So things like that.
There were
a number of such occurrences, and I lived through them.
When you were a fighter pilot, did you see action?
No, I was in active duty between the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And so I did not. There were some other, some other things going on.
Let's see. How about your German side and your American side? How do you think about that?
That's interesting. Personally, I never considered myself anything but American. American attitudes, American belief systems, American whatever. I lived in Germany for 2 years of my life. I wasn't raised in the home to focus on the Germanness. I was aware that my parents were German. I was aware of their origin. I was aware that I had some relatives there. I've lived there for 2 years, but it's almost as though I'm just visiting a place and I have some contact with it or some attachment to it, but there hasn't been any emotional or mental attachment. Mm-hmm. And so that's the best answer I can give there. I can't describe it any other way. I don't feel any affinity for the country of Germany at all, other than that it's a place and I visited it. And because I think the imprint on me as a young boy was an American imprint. So it doesn't. I don't have any affinity toward there, except maybe some things. A pride in my father's education and his abilities, and so forth. Uh-huh. That's about all.
Why don't you say something about the court case that a number of people whose families were involved in the whole internment, and if you could just say for the tape what it's about and why you particularly are interested in being a part of that whole move?
I'm involved in the movement to get recognition by the U.S. government that German Americans were interned during World War II because I feel there was an unjust process involved and that many, if not all of those Germans that interned lost a substantial portion of their livelihood, of their possessions, of their life for this unjust internment, and it should be recognized as such, coincident with any such behavior by a government toward people who are resident in the country and trying to make a life in that country in a legal way. So to this point, of the three major ethnic groups in the U.S. that were interned, the Japanese, the Italians, and the Germans, only the German internments have not been recognized by Congress. And I feel that we should be so recognized, and so that the injustice of that internment can be brought to the attention of the population at whole, and that it won't occur again in this manner. Mm-hmm. I think the process in which occurred was unjust, and we should not, as a country, condone such a process again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever talk with your father about how he came to think about all the things that had happened in his life, the arrests and the beatings and all? I mean, did he ever talk about that in his old, well, before he died? He really didn't reach old age.
No, unfortunately, after he returned to this country, I was on active duty in the Air Force, and I was away from where they were living. And then on times when I was in the same area, he was busy trying to make a living and pretty much exhausted. So we never did talk mm-hmm. about that at that time. Mm-hmm. They arrived when he was 60, and he died at 65, which is a good amount of time, but really it was very, very meager mm-hmm. relative to what was going on in both of our lives. And we never did get a chance to discuss that.
Yeah.
He was, I do know that he was angry about it all, but angry mostly in the fact that he felt he was very innocent of any wrongdoing and had paid for it with, you know, for... I think at one point he said something to the effect that he never got so much as a traffic ticket and he still was incarcerated for 5 years of his life. Mm-hmm. And so I know he was angry and upset about it, but again, he was more preoccupied with trying to make a life.
Mm-hmm. How about your older sister? Were there any ramifications that you know of the ordeal for her?
Well, I think in a sense it did have stronger effects on her, in the fact that when we were in Germany for the time period, the schools were closed mostly, and then we were in the refugee camp, and then coming here. So in the sense it really terminated her education. She never got back on track again in terms of high school or even going to college. And so it did have a strong effect that way. She wasn't able to attain a level of education that I think she was capable of. Just mm-hmm. and thus it did affect her life.
Okay. Is there anything else you can think of relevant to? I mean, how close do you think this group is coming to getting some kind of recognition of what the government did to the interned Germans during World War II at this point?
I think the current administration, it's not a priority at all. And so I think any effort will have to be continually pursued because the current administration has other priorities that are taking up its political efforts and its expenditures of time and money and whatever.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an ongoing effort, and will have to be intensified.
Yeah.
We're basically requesting recognition. We're not requesting remuneration or anything else. We just want a recognition that there were a number of Germans that were interned, most of them unjustly, and the government has failed to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
One of the things that used to disturb me when I was in college was I would go to the history books and go to the indexes, and there never was anything. There was always something in there about Japanese internment. And I knew I had been interned, and I could never find anywhere in the books anything about German internment. And still today, there are very, very few books that mention it at all, and certainly none of the texts in college. Mm-hmm. It's just, and if you talk to a college professor, they'll tell you, no, it didn't happen, just point blank. Uh-huh. And I've heard that, no, it didn't happen in another place.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah.
My concern is that we need to acknowledge things that did happen so they don't happen again.
Uh huh. Okay. Well, that might be the place to end. I want to thank you very much for a most interesting interview, and I've been speaking with Lothar Iserlohr, who was born in this country, and he and his family were repatriated or exchanged in 1945, and he returned to this country in 1947. This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm signing off.